Welcome again to Season 2 of Food Conversations, a program about food and all its aspects from planting seeds to eating, with a special emphasis on establishing food sovereignty in the Sioux Swap. I'm your host, Warren Bell, and you're listening to us on CKVS FM 93.7, the voice of the Sioux Swap, community radio for the people, with the people, and by the people. We're back on the air now after the summer growing season and the autumn harvesting season. Many of you will have been out in your gardens or your fields, planting, picking, and preserving food for the rest of the year or to sell into the market. Now, as winter approaches, we're settling in for a time of planning, preparation, and pondering the future after no ordinary summer, a summer of disruptive wildfires, extreme heat, and drought-like conditions, a summer that may well become a way of life in the Sioux Swap. In the background and on all our minds is the ever-increasing presence of the climate crisis and the wide range of human-caused environmental problems that are changing our daily lives. As environmental challenges increase, food sovereignty, having access to local, healthy food, becomes an increasingly higher priority. Did you know, for example, that a 750-gram container of yogurt produced locally generates less than one-seventh the greenhouse gases as the same yogurt shipped from Montreal? Today, I'm delighted to welcome back to Food Conversations someone who knows as well as anyone in this region about the need for change in the world of food. And that person is agricultural economist Andrea Gunner, co-owner of Rosebank Farms, and an expert on food systems in our region as well as around the world. Welcome again, Andrea.
Thank you, Warren. It's a pleasure to be here as always.
We're delighted to have you on the program, and we're going to have an interesting discussion today. I will remind listeners, by the way, that we're talking to Andrea over Zoom and we're observing all the appropriate COVID-19 precautions in the studio. Now, Andrea, you have a busy life at the best of times, but running as a candidate in a federal election adds a whole new level of complication, hyperactivity, and sometimes even sleepless nights. Can you comment a little bit about on what changed when you put your name forward and became a candidate officially in the federal election recently?
Everything. No, not quite everything. But the biggest thing that changed was the volume of emails that I get. I normally get about 100 emails a day that I need to deal with on behalf of clients, customers, people in my life. I can't just delete them all. That doesn't include the ones that I delete, of which there are probably 40 or 50 more. And so the number that I needed to deal with doubled. So I went from, you know, reading emails from 7 to 8:30 or 9 o'clock in the morning to needing to do that from 5 to 9 in the morning just to keep abreast of things. And then there were all the requests for information, for writings, appearances, all of those things that I also had to respond to in a more thoughtful manner.
And did the tone of the emails that you received change somewhat? Did you notice a different flavor, as it were?
I think that mostly it was just the ones that were to do with the federal election. Of course, there was Elections Canada. There was a lot of volume from them. There was a lot of volume from the party. And that just was a different thing to deal with. There were a lot from media. There were a lot from community groups and the forums, of course, wanting to get. So the coordination of what my schedule was going to look like.
Yes, your life took off and no longer became your own in certain respects.
In a certain respect. I'm used to wearing a lot of hats and juggling a lot of things. So it wasn't completely new to me. It was the volume was certainly strained my organizational abilities.
Sure.
And because of that because of the complexity of my existing life, it didn't make sense for my campaign manager to deal with that because my schedule is so full already.
I feel your pain. I wonder what it was that led you to take this step. This is you knew what you were doing, but at the same time, you did it. You knew that it was going to increase the work you had to do, but also you did say, I will become the candidate. What does it led you to do that?
The reason that I said yes this time, because I have been invited by a variety of political parties over the last 20 odd years to run for as their candidate, and I have always declined the opportunity because I see myself as more of an activist than a politician. But this time I said yes because I am so frustrated and I'm beyond angry. I'm well past that anger grieving stage into the, I have to do action. I'm only one person, but I can do something. And to go ahead and do something by standing up for my beliefs that we can change policy, we can do things as individuals, as society, as government, to actually address climate change, as had been the case some 30 years ago when Brian Mulroney, the progressive conservative prime minister, had led Canada into the forefront of climate action on the global level. And the fact that we've changed so much so that we're now in the rear, you know, dragging at the tail end, that was what really impelled me, that I am beyond concerned. I am freaked even before this happened, what I see happening.
So to help you and help me and help our audience today to understand what it is that we're so far behind on, because I think there are many issues that Canada and BC are behind on, what do you perceive as the things we're most behind on that are making you feel freaked?
Oh, the difference in Canada's governance model, where the provinces have jurisdiction over some things and the federal government has jurisdiction over some things, they're not always well aligned. And so what has happened with the energy industry has really changed how they perceive what they can do. And that has hobbled our government as a full functioning body.
On that note, Andrea, maybe you could comment on the fact that and listeners may not be aware of this, the fact that there is a memorandum of understanding between the Agricultural Land Commission and the Oil and Gas Commission, which allows the latter, the ONG, Oil and Gas Commission, to supervise land management, especially in northeastern BC, where the energy industry is going wild with endless drilling of natural gas, so-called natural gas, methane, to be more precise, wells all over farmland, prime farmland in the Peace River area. Could you comment? Because that's germane to what you're just saying.
Yes. So one of the things that happens in government, and I knew this before I entered politics, but it really was brought home, is that the decisions that our representatives make on behalf of us, their constituents, are not purely in our interest. They have to balance those with economic interests, which are mostly driven by economy. And that really is a challenge because I don't think it serves the vast population as well as it might. So that particular example that you just gave is very true. We have, as we know, 1% of the land in BC is suitable for agriculture. And some of the land up in the Peace River, because of climate change, they've got a much longer growing season than they did 20 or 30 years ago. And yet, between both Site C and the oil and gas sector, they They don't have the capacity. They don't have full autonomy over making the best use.
Indeed. And that is something that is, I've been to the Peace River area a couple of times, and it's horrifying to see farmers leaving the land, going to, say, Dawson Creek and taking $50,000 from the oil and gas industry to lease their part of their land for drilling an oil well or a gas well, because the interruption to their lives otherwise is so huge. There are microfeeder pipes all over the place. There's multi well pads which make noise and burn off hydrogen sulfide 24/7. It's become what the local people often call a sacrifice zone. And the sacrifice is the food system in that area. The people who grow food, who grow an incredible amount of grain for use in this province and for export, are being driven off the land by this fixation with fossil fuel energy.
Yeah, I'm not sure what to comment about that, except to say it is true. I did a profile of the grain industry when I was a university student, and spent about 3 weeks in the Peace River. And I'm sad to say that, because government resources being what they are, that study that I did some 30 years ago is still the definitive study of the grain industry in the Peace River, even though it is terribly outdated.
My Lord, my Lord. So let's get back to your life over the last few couple of months while this election campaign was on. What was a typical day for you as a political campaigner? What was it like?
So my typical day started at 5 a.m. with spending 4 hours on the computer. I forsake my daily yoga practice and ate breakfast at the computer every morning. So 4 hours of dealing with emails. And then usually, because I still have a farm, I can't put that on hold. And I still had clients, so I couldn't put them on hold. So then I would try and work between sort of 10 till 2 to do the administration for the farm and deal with my clients writing reports and whatnot. And then I would spend from 2 o'clock until 4 o'clock, either writing for requests for interviews, preparing for forums. So I would do that for a couple of hours. And then I would either have some kind of event where I would be meeting people and answering their questions, and then going into, I think there were 8 forums, so preparing for those or actually being at those. And then I would, luckily I have a very supportive family, so somebody would have made me meals in there and brought them to my desk.
They fed and watered you.
They fed and watered me, yeah, made sure that the basic functioning was being carried out. And then I would spend, if I wasn't in a meeting or a forum that evening, then I would spend from 7 o'clock until midnight or 1 o'clock in the morning, dealing with all the things that I had missed during the day and getting prepared for the next day.
So what important
it personal... is absolutely amazing how many people I would send an email at 1 in the morning and go to bed, and how many people would have responded to that by 5 o'clock in the morning when I
This is scary. The whole population is wide awake 24/7.
Oh, yeah. So there are a lot of people that don't get enough sleep.
So what did you learn about, and I'm going to use this word, organization, your own and the world's?
I always feel like I am not organized enough for my life. But in retrospect, I am way more organized than most people, and pretty on it. I think that without pretty superior organizational skills, it would be very hard to run a political campaign. And I contrast that with the fact that my husband ran twice for provincial politics, and in both cases had a campaign manager where he just showed up and did what had to be done. He did do the research for answering questions and all that, but he really had a pretty light run of it.
He had a manager.
having a manager that basically took over his life. I made sure that he was fed and watered and that the farm was looked after so that he could do what he needed to. I didn't have that particular situation because, as a sole proprietor of a consulting business, I'm it. So I couldn't put that on hold.
It does bring to mind the whole notion of women multitasking and men thinking of one thing at a time. I won't necessarily elaborate on that remark, but it clearly is something that you had to do. You had absolutely no choice under the circumstances. Now, you said earlier about how freaked you felt about the way things are going and about how maybe there's more rhetoric floating around than there is action. And specifically with regard to the relationship between the changing climate, which is clearly changing and is changing because of human activity. What did you start to think as you were engaged in this political talk process about Canada and BC's talk versus action with respect to this looming and ever-present climate crisis that we're surrounded by?
With due consideration, I believe that BC has been better positioned. The initiation of the carbon tax under the previous government, the changes that the current government has made, I think that BC has done a much better job. And I think that would be true across the country, that there are individual municipalities as well as areas of the country that are being more climate action aware and moving policies that way. At the federal level, that doesn't seem to be the case. There's a lot of rhetoric and not a lot of action. And
Andrea.
so looking at that through the federal lens as a federal candidate was disheartening for sure.
I was just reflecting on the fact that the same premier of this province who brought in the carbon tax was also the premier under whose jurisdiction the ONG was given responsibility for land management. It does indicate a little bit of the sort of ambivalence at the political level. On the one hand, doing something positive, and on the other hand, slipping back into an antediluvian attitude towards the state of the world that we live in. Now, you also have over time. We can talk about this more next week when we talk about future plans and the way things are going or need to go. But there are a number of farmers and ranchers who are starting to act on the ground that you know that are helping to unburden you of this sense of doom and concern. And some of them you know.
Yes. So this was the other reason that I wanted to run for the federal campaign, because I have such a sense of hope and optimism that I haven't had for a long time. And it's because of farmers across North America, certainly in Europe as well, that are doing really innovative. They're bringing innovation into agriculture, and it's interesting because it heads back to Sir Albert Howard, who was in the late 1800s, and some of the scientists who found out about the biological connection of soil, and now are being celebrated and have their teachings and their learnings followed in some really, really interesting ways, adding technology into that and adding an awareness of the biological processes. So the first thing I think that happened is one of the things that I do is I teach a course at TRU's Sustainable Ranching Program up in Williams Lake every fall. And the students in that course are really looking at sustainability from all the pillars, the ecological, the economic, and the social pillars of farming. And so they have sort of the top people in the industry in not just Western Canada, but Western North America come in as sessional lecturers for them.
And would you say that many of these are younger farmers or older farmers or all across the board in age?
Mostly they are the incoming generation of of ranchers.
Ranchers.
Ranching, you know, the demographic in Canada is an aging demographic, and farming is no different. And ranches often have significant capital, and it tends to stay within the family, because unless you're the owner of Walmart, you can't afford to buy a ranch. You can afford to inherit it if you're born into the right family. But the margins are slim, and so you need to be very, very good at what you do, at your skills. And this program has been going for about 5 years now, and it is attracting students from around the world. They're not just coming from BC, they're coming from across Canada and overseas. And they alerted me to the fact that there is an organization called the Western Canada Soil Health Group that's actually based in Edmonton, mm-hmm. Alberta.
Right.
Also the oil and gas industry.
Another one of these anomalous conflicts.
Anyway, I was lucky enough to go to their conference in 2019 and met a bunch of farmers, some of whom I knew, and a bunch of new farmers there who are putting these biological, microbiological practices into practice on their farms, on their ranches, on extensive acreages. And that was the first time, well, probably not the first time, it's probably the second time that I actually thought, you know, we can do this. We can actually turn this around. The soil can be a huge carbon sink, and not just to reduce our carbon emissions, but actually draw down and sequester them in long term. And there are a bunch of people here in BC that are doing it. And I was really happy to meet people across Western Canada who were doing it. BC's got a very small arable land base. We've got, of course, lots of forest, lots of trees, lots of mountains. But the Great Prairies have got vast amounts. And if farmers there start to use these practices, what they're finding is that not only are they sequestering carbon, and there's some research that's going on that's measuring that, but they're holding water. And so the farmers that have been using these practices for the last few years actually came through the drought this year really well, exceptionally well, compared to their neighbors who aren't using these practices. So that's just one of those outcomes that it's good for the soil, it's good for the farmer, it's good for all of us.
So Andrea, here are you, an agricultural economist, running in a political process, and the candidates for other parties are not only have quite different backgrounds, but their expertise in any particular field, although the Liberal candidate, I understand, was involved in a company that does a lot of work with GPS, which engages one in land assessment and land examining land parameters. What was it like running as a candidate in this group of candidates? But candidates always sort of share a few things that they don't admit that they share. What was it like to see candidates around you who really didn't have much of an idea about what's actually going on with respect to the things we've just been talking about, the impact of climate, the need to do something about it, the need to act rather than just talk? What was that like for you?
Well, you know, the interesting thing is when I meet people and talk to them, whether they're in the grocery store or in something more, I belong to two book clubs and I give a lot of presentations. So I meet a lot of people, many more people than I can actually remember. And something that has been common in my life for the last 20 years is people saying to me, wow, I never knew that. And you sure know a lot. So it didn't surprise me to be on in an all candidates forum and be able to talk off the top of my head without having to scramble through the political platform handbook, because I just know a lot. I'm a voracious reader. I do over 100 hours a year of professional development. So I take courses. I read a lot. Yeah, I already said I read voraciously. I'm a voracious omnivore of nonfiction and
Intellectual
fiction.
material of all sorts, yes.
Yeah. I'm curious. So it wasn't that different to find myself on stage knowing more than the rest of the people
So,
about most of the topics.
did you have conversations with your fellow candidates in which this experience you just described, where you would say something, they say, "Oh, I didn't know that." Did you have any experiences like that? Was there any kind of fellow feeling
Yes.
among the candidates? Talk about that a little bit.
Yes. So, to his credit, Mel Arnold was the one who stood out the most with that, but also Kyle Deering, who was running for the PPC. Mel, of course, as the listeners will know, has been our representative in Ottawa for the last 6 years and has been reelected. And he not only did Mel reach out, but his staff reached out as well to say, wow, that was really interesting. I learned a lot and you had a lot of interesting ideas. And then to his credit, Mel reached out to me the morning after the election to say, I learned a lot from you on the campaign and I would like to sit down together and have a conversation. And so that we're playing telephone tag right now. Hopefully by the end of the day, we'll have something set up for before he goes back to Ottawa. My schedule is pretty full, but his is too.
I think many people would be pleased to hear that there was a sort of collaborative fellow feeling to some degree among the candidates in the election. And I know that many voters and commentators expressed distress that at the leadership level, at federally, there was far too much sniping and bickering and criticism going back and forth. Did you get that sense as you were talking to people that they wanted people to get on and address the problems rather than trying to criticize one another at the political level?
Very clearly, very clearly. A number of people are very distressed that the leaders act worse than unruly 6-year-olds. I don't know a kindergarten teacher who would put up with that kind of behavior. And there were a lot of people that shared that sentiment, that they stopped watching the leaders debate. They don't watch leaders debates anymore. If they did tune in, they stopped after just a few minutes because it's such a dysfunctional system. And people who did really get a lot out of the forums, those people who attended, who were not necessarily party supporters, but just curious to make sure that their vote was going to count and go to the person that best represented their interests and views. And those people that I met that, like I say, were not particular supporters of my party, but a number of people did comment that the forums were very useful and interesting to watch as compared to the leaders' debates.
Yes, I think there's a growing sentiment that action in the political arena is often peripheral to what's actually going on, if I can use the analogy again, on the land. What's going on in communities and in local activities where the change is actually taking place. What was your experience in the one forum that was quite different in its structure, and appropriately, it was the food forum. It was a
That
different format.
it was a very different format, and I intend to reach out to both the Salmon Arm Chamber of Commerce and the Vernon Chamber of Commerce to let them know about that forum and what was so useful about it. Because for those listeners who didn't attend that forum, there was a panel of industry participants. So, farmers, food processors, food security folks who actually work with the issue day to day to day. And they explained their situation this past season, what was important to them, what had happened to them. So, providing some context and then asking a question with that background. And the other candidates, unfortunately, not all of the candidates were able to participate. But at the end, I think Mel and I were the only candidates that were still there at the end. And it was really interesting because the questions were provided nuance and background and a more holistic view of what the issues really are. And the answers that we gave still had to be within a time frame, but there was a much better understanding. So there was an education component to it, which was really, really great. If the Chambers of Commerce were to do that and have business people, business owners, and the commercial and corporate community providing that kind of context about what their issues are, not only the candidates, the political candidates, but also the community as a whole would find out a lot more, and it would be much more interesting format. So,
and that strikes me as of a change of tone and a change of quality of the exchange, because what you're describing is a situation where everybody's got some knowledge, but it's different knowledge, and learning from one another brings about better solutions. That's what I sense you're describing.
Yes, exactly. And it's something that we really need in all our decision-making structures, is that people actually listen to diverse perspectives and then find a way forward. Of course, everybody needs to compromise a bit, but if you hear all those diverse perspectives, you're going to craft a better solution that's going to be more effective for more people.
The other thing that seems to be part of what you're describing at the Food Forum, which I did attend, and I was very impressed by that kind of format. Initially, I thought it was going to just add time to the evening, but in fact, it focused the discussion around really significant issues and brought out nuance, as you say. But the underlying principle there is also diversity. Everybody's got a place. The farmers and the ranchers had a place. The candidates had a place. The forum organizers had a place. It was sort of a much more collective kind of event.
It was like a talking circle.
Yes, something else we've learned about from our Indigenous friends and neighbors, that we need to sit in circles rather than have lectures from lecterns at the front of the room. On that note, what else did you? You also had another decent experience at Sorrento Center. Different, but decent. And what was satisfying about that for you?
The interview was a series of questions that I had presented to me beforehand. And I looked at the questions and really struggled with them. And at the start of the interview, suggested a change in format.
What were you struggling with in the questions? What were the questions not right for you, or just as questions?
They demanded such long, complex answers that I didn't think that anybody was actually going to listen.
Yeah, simple question. Why is there air? Could you please answer that in 25 words or less? Yeah, that's happened before. So what did you do? You changed the format.
I changed the format, and I said, you know, I think that these are the big issues. I want to hear from you what you think the big issues are, and then let's have a conversation about that. And so, again, I changed it into, this is more of a discussion where we can learn from each other, because as a political candidate, really every political candidate should spend more time listening and asking questions than talking. And so that's what I tried to do.
You also would have brought, as we've already discussed today, a considerable amount of expertise, as opposed to sometimes candidates who are simply there because they've agreed to stand up and be counted, but their knowledge of any particular subject is fairly limited. That this seems like your personal attributes were brought forward rather than being shaped into some kind of bland party policy framework, which you just repeated. You actually were engaging in shaping the process. Is that about right?
Yeah, that would be my personality. And because I've got the background that I do, because I've been in leadership positions for most, if not all, of my adult life, I have that ability and I have some expertise and experience with it. So yes, I did bring that.
Generally speaking, would you see the process of running as a candidate brings out or allows you to express that? In this particular case at Sorrento Center, you had an opportunity. The people there, I think it's Michael Shapcoat and others, were responsive to you saying, well, no, this isn't going to work. Why don't we try it this way? But many of the fora, apart from the food forum, were not necessarily like that. The questions might have been there and might have had some background to them, but not as fulsome, not as incomplete as the background that you generated or that was generated in food forum and then that you facilitated at Sorrento Center. That must have been sort of compare and contrast those two experiences versus many of the other ones. What?
Sorry, I just had to deal with an incoming phone call.
Life continues.
Yes, sorry. So compare and contrast. And to do that in a way, I think as somebody who has attended political forums in the past, I have always made a note, maybe not of going to all of them, but certainly going to a representation, whether it's municipal, provincial, or federal levels. And the format where questions are fired, usually it's 1 or 2 minutes of question, and then the candidate is given 1 or 2 minutes to answer. Oftentimes, people are really smart, mm-hmm. and they bring really, really interesting, complex questions that you could easily have a half hour or 4 hour discussion, but you're given 1 to 2 minutes to answer it. And so as somebody who has attended forums a number of times, I find that frustrating. I find that having a more time to actually explore the person's values, you get a bit of a sense of that in 1 or 2 minutes, but mostly you see how they behave under pressure over and over and over and over and over again. And hardly anybody cracks. I mean, some people are not very comfortable with the format, but it's not a good test of somebody who's going to make really clear, balanced, thoughtful shaping of policy going forward. I know because I have friends who are cabinet ministers, I have friends who are MLAs and MPs, I know that they get a lot of information, which is never enough to make the decisions that they're called on to make. And so if they are not able to bring other resources to bear, they are reliant on staff, they're reliant on the material that's given to them. They might not have a framework, they might not have a perspective that is full enough to make those good decisions. Plus, in our democratic system in Canada, the parties vote, the candidates, the representatives vote as they're told to vote for the most part. And that to me is deeply troubling. I felt betrayed when we're still 2 elections past the one that was promised as never again will we have first past the post.
I'm glad you brought up proportional.
I look at other countries in the world, and Canada, the US, and the UK are the holdouts on that first past the post system. The other democracies have all gone to minority or coalition type governments to get that diverse perspective and to really get the nuances of doing the best thing for the population. And it makes me angry that we're not there.
So inevitably, when we talk about these sort of structural issues with respect to the election, we're talking about how the electoral system itself is set up. And although I used the word proportional, and you just described the process, which I think was probably more useful. The fact is that we have a system that encourages people becoming hyper-partisan, constantly trying to tear down the position of candidates representing other parties. I saw a little bit of that in a couple of fora that I attended between the Liberal candidate and the Conservative Party candidate, because they are considered to be sort of the ones most likely to form a government. But it was, what you're describing is moving beyond that, moving to an inclusive dialogue-oriented process which leads to action that's concerted because everybody's on the same page. That's sort of summarizing a little bit of what you said. Does that seem appropriate as I described it?
Yes, and it's interesting that it was actually under a progressive conservative government that Elizabeth May was one of, so Elizabeth May, for those people who don't know, was the longtime leader of the Green Party, was the first Green Party elected representative in Canada's parliament. Before that time, before she ever ran for politics, she was part of an industry advisory panel that the conservative minister of environment took the best and brightest minds from industry, from the environmental movement, and that's how Canada led the world in crafting climate action policies. And we haven't had that kind of, we've had increasing partisanship since. And as you say, we've had this sort of mudslinging as if the people who have different ideas to your own are not to be valued, not to be listened to. And I find that very distressing. If somebody's busy insulting me, I'm not going to be very trustful that they're going to listen to me when I have something really, really important to say. And the same thing, if I'm closing my mind off to somebody else and thinking, oh, that person's such a dingbat, I'm not going to honor those gems of truth that actually do fall from their lips, because everybody has their own perspective and has their own truth. And it's important to be open and non-judgmental. Just because they appear like a dingbat, even dingbats have things that are real and true and honest. And none of us should be so arrogant that we believe that we can't learn from everyone else.
Perhaps we'll find out one day that dingbats are a species that we had not yet identified and turned out to be playing a very important role in an ecosystem somewhere, and we should probably propagate them a little bit more.
Yeah. I watched a worm this morning do problem solving and make...
Andrea, I'm sorry. Watched a worm doing problem solving. That is,
I did.
I think that should be enshrined over some doorway somewhere. Today, I watched a worm problem solving. Tell me what the worm was doing.
The worm was on the edge of a puddle, and he anchored he. I'm using he.
That's a bit worm, anthropomorphic.
The worm anchored his tail on the side of the puddle and went in various directions across the puddle trying to get to the other side. And I watched for 5 minutes until the worm found the shortest direction across the puddle and gathered itself up and made its way successfully across the puddle to the other side without drowning.
Andrea, a phrase comes to mind, earthworm for Nobel Peace Prize. There's something about the wonder of what you've just described that I think kind of sums up our entire conversation and then adds a whole new dimension to it.
A peace prize would probably be a bit of a stretch.
Could you think of another one that would work? Prize for science?
Mathematics,
physics, we'll take anything. Andrea, what we're talking about is the structure of political discourse in this country. Obviously, it has some glaring imperfections. And one of the outcomes of that is that it places burdens on political representatives which are equally distorted. Could you talk about that a little bit?
And really onerous. I know that people who run for politics, from those that I have met and have in my life, they are thoughtful, considerate, concerned people who care and want to give back to society because they feel that they've benefited in some way or because they see inequality. They are good-hearted people, well-intentioned people. And the system, I think, is very challenging, is not supportive because it puts them in confrontation more than in collaboration. And that doesn't serve us well. That doesn't serve society well.
It is actually something that people are starting to notice, as everyone, I'm sure, listening to the show knows, that there's a lot of conversations around proportional representation as a system. And the fact that it discourages, it means that the person who you perceive one day to be your political, quote, enemy, tomorrow could be your political, quote, friend. And therefore, it is important for you to actually maintain a level of civility and openness to dialogue. That wasn't something you had to say. Go ahead.
No, and you're right. I think the best ideas and the best ways forward come when we talk and listen honestly to each other rather than shutting each other out because they're on a different perspective. In the boards that I've worked on, it's always best when you have a board that's got diversity, a diversity of opinion, diversity of background experience. You get much more full and considered ways forward. And I don't see that happening in Canadian, certainly not in the federal politics that I observe.
So we're talking about two kinds of structural change. One is the electoral system, how we vote for people. And the other is how we organize a campaign when a decision has been taken to hold an election. If you were able to, just to summarize a little bit, if you were able to redesign, say, the election process or the running an election, how would you set it up?
Well, for one thing, Elections Canada is transferring from paper-based to online electronic-based. And that was not without its issues. Of course, everything, when you're trying to change something, there are growing pains from it. There was a very short election period, so probably wasn't as good as it will be next time. But certainly moving in that direction is it's going to be more streamlined, cheaper, so not as expensive, and more effective in the long run. But it's going to take us at least one more time, I think, before we get that right.
So when you say electronic, you're talking about so many meetings that were held as Zoom meetings and online or other kinds of processes? Because Zoom really does mean a very significant change in the way discussions take place and discourse and dialogue takes place.
That's part of it, but Elections Canada has a lot of paperwork. So the nomination process, there's the nomination process within the political party, and then there's the nomination process within Elections Canada. So once you've been nominated as the candidate, then you have this fairly onerous process to go through, and there are time constraints on it. So once you get your full package together, and it has got a myriad of elements to it, then you have to upload that. There's a website under Elections Canada, and you upload that. But because Elections Canada staff who've done it before are still very much paper-based, they also wanted to have it on paper too. And so there was some juggling there that went back and forth. The process on the website was duplicated, and the duplicates were not equal to each other. So it was easy to go down the wrong trail. And that will be one thing. But then in terms of the actual governance, I don't know how to design that. I'm not a political scientist. I'm sure there are people much better qualified than I am to take a look at that.
So did you talk to your husband, Steve, about what his experience was like, which was all in person, and your experience that was on Zoom? So that changed things too.
Yes. For one thing, it meant that I didn't have nearly as active a campaign. I spent a lot of campaign sitting at my desk in front of my computer, and whereas his was door knocking and main streeting and doing all of that, he was much more physically active, whereas almost all my meetings were on Zoom. I had, I think, two or maybe three that were in person, you know, main streeting type things, where it wasn't actually main streeting, it was just being downtown where people came. I was lucky in that I attend the farmers market, the old organic farmers market in the uptown Askew's parking lot on Wednesday afternoon. So I had a lot of people that came to see me there, that 3 hours a week. And other than that, I was sitting at my desk in front of the computer, meeting people that way.
So having ridden through this process and sensing, as you said at the beginning of our show, you said how freaked you were about the fact that there's a lot of talk and there isn't a lot of action. How would you say running this campaign has, if it has, changed you or affected your ideas and your perceptions about what we need to do from here forward?
Well, I already knew that we need a lot more civic engagement. I really came, I think, to that understanding in triplicate, because the one person that we elect is one of 338. They do not, and honestly, they should not have the kind of influence that a community of concerned citizens can and does have. And so I'm seeing a lot more activism by just normal citizens who say that what we're doing at the federal level is not good enough and looking to get organized for municipal elections for next year, as an example. Mm-hmm. And so people saying, I can't do everything, but I can do something, and this is what I'm going to do. So Melanie Bennett's idea of having these food conversations and Askew's coming along to sponsor them, I'm sure that that was a mutual outreach. Askew's didn't come up with the idea. Melanie did, but Askew's has stepped up to support it. And
very much so.
That is one of those situations of, I'm only one person, but I can do something. What can I do? And a lot of people aren't good at having ideas. Some people are very good at having ideas. And if they're willing to spread those ideas around, well, that's how we get society to move in a different direction. So that idea of actually talking to your friends and neighbors and coworkers and saying, I'm really concerned about whatever the issue is that you're concerned about, and having a dialogue about it. People are the older I get, the more I am humbled by how good-hearted, considerate, and caring almost everybody is. There are relatively few people who are in such distress themselves that when they find out somebody else is in distress, they don't reach a helping hand. Almost everybody does, in whatever capacity they're able.
Yeah, and that's a point that's often made in my line of work, which is the healthcare sector, that everybody sort of wants things to go better. It's just that they need to have a better discussion. And in fact, the college that oversees my work declares repeatedly that the biggest problem between doctors and patients is communication, which means respect, time, and listening. Qualities that you were talking about a lot during the sort of election campaign. We're coming near to the end of the show. Do you have any final comments about your brief comments about your political foray and what it's left in your heart or in mind?
I think the thing that I wanted to do at the beginning, I've managed to accomplish. The thing that I wanted to do was to raise the idea that there are tools, techniques, there are policies that we can enact that really can turn this huge ship in a different direction. And the time to do that is now. It's actually past, but better late than never. And I feel that I was heard. I was heard by members of the public. I was certainly heard by the other candidates. And so Kyle Delfing, again, the PPC, has asked if he can come to the farm and see what we're doing on the farm, because he was very interested in that. Mel has reached out to me to say, yes, I need to learn more from you. So the idea that people are wanting to make change is palpable. It's more than it's as much as I hoped.
That's the best any of us can hope for. So next week, we're going to ask you back to talk about some of those changes and where we need to go, and something more about on-the-ground change rather than rhetorical change. Thank you very much, Andrea, for being with us today. I look forward to talking to you next week. And thank you for joining us specifically on this program about food, Food Conversations. And to listeners, please tune in next week for our next Food Conversations. Thank you very much, Andrea, again.
Thank you.
This new series starting this fall of Food Conversations for 2021 are produced by Shelley Corbin, Warren Bell, and Steve Gorey. And the idea came from Melanie Bennett in collaboration with the Shuswap Food Action Society.